Welcome back to another episode of Hip Hop Social Worker with Christopher Scott. And today, I have another special guest, my mom, Mrs. Cheryl Moten.
Hello.
So, I figured, to have both my parents on, my mom especially, because she's the one that kind of steered me into the direction of social work. So, my parents, like I said before on my first episode, my upbringing kind of is the reason why I got into social work. And, my mom and dad can really explain it better than I can. I think give you another perspective of kind of some of the stuff that I witnessed. Good times, bad times, challenging times, getting over humps, setting goals, getting things done. So, hey, how you doing today?
I'm good. Just getting off work.
That's what we always do, get off work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind going into what you do for a living?
Well, I am a CDAC, too.
Mm-hmm.
And also a QMHA, which is a Qualified Mental Health Associate.
Yeah.
I'm not a professional yet, but I'm working on it. I've been working on the field of addictions for the last 17 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got my CADC about 10 years ago, I would say.
Okay.
And then started with my one and then worked on and received my two.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And you are kind of like, so you don't do like dual diagnosis?
Well, I do work with alongside of a mental health professional or a QMHP.
Okay.
We work side by side. A lot of my clients are dual diagnosis. And so it's important that I'm working with the mental health therapist, but I am not diagnosing clients.
Mm-hmm.
But if I see symptoms or the mental health therapists have issues in regards to addictions, then we work side by side.
Okay. All right. And because, you drove me to go get my master's degree, I am actually a QMHP.
Mm-hmm.
And, let's throw some air horns on that. I won't do no more sound effects anymore. So you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about your upbringing and things like that? What drove you to this work?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I am the youngest of 10. My background is, it's a little different. I was raised by my aunt.
Mm-hmm.
My biological mother passed away when I was 2 months old.
Yeah.
And the 9 kids were given to my grandmother, and I was given to my aunt, who raised me.
Yeah.
So that is who I refer to as my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school in Portland, Oregon. Then I was bused out in the 6th grade and went to Robert Gray, went out to Beaverton. And so then came back into the neighborhood. It was a real culture shock for me at that time because, going out to a school where there's like 5 or 6 African Americans.
Yeah.
So, my best friend was not African American and the culture was not African American. But then going back to the hood, there was a lot of, I wouldn't say bullying, but I didn't speak like other African Americans.
Yeah.
So that was really difficult. So I tried to find my way.
Mm-hmm.
Met your dad when I was 15.
Yeah.
And we immediately got into a relationship. Got pregnant when I was 17.
Yeah.
Married when I was 18.
Oh, okay.
And then shortly after that, your brother Brandon, and then you came along.
You forgot Kenny.
Kenny was my first.
You said, okay.
My bad. Yeah. I'm sorry. That's okay. It's all right. I don't forget any of you guys. Just my upbringing, it was a real religious household,
mm-hmm.
Kind of sheltered.
Yeah.
But I knew I wanted an out. And so my out was I'll get pregnant, have a family of my own,
mm-hmm.
and then I would just go on to do grown-up things.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is that I was 16.
Yeah.
You know, so trying to do grown-up things at 16, it just didn't mesh up.
Yeah.
So, you know, some hard times. You know, addiction was, or drugs were introduced into our life by other family members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't do drugs early on, and neither did your dad. But the people around us,
mm-hmm.
you know, were doing drugs and selling drugs. And I don't think we really got into heavy drugs until after your grandpa, Albert, passed away.
Yeah.
I think that was the real turning point for us.
Mm-hmm.
So went down that road. My goodness, it seemed like it was a lifetime, but it wasn't. It was, yeah. We were in our addiction for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like it was forever. That yeah. was the longest 6 years of my life.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, some things happened, and your dad went to prison, and, you know, then I really hit bottom,
mm-hmm.
you know, because even when we were using, he still kind of kept me sheltered from stuff.
Yeah.
But then when he was gone, I was forced to kind of get out there and do my own hustle and things like that. And so went through a lot of stuff, and it was actually your Aunt Pat
yeah.
that stepped in and said, okay, so your grandparents were sick. You know, your grandma had a stroke, and they were sickly, and I was just running amok.
Yeah.
You know, and so the family stepped in and said, we need to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember going into court and just being just devastated about how can family do this? You know, how could family do this?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even then, I think that, you know, higher power was working because yeah. we were able to come up with a solution.
Yeah.
You know, so that you guys went into care and. I continued to use for a little while longer, but then got into treatment,
mm-hmm.
you know, completed treatment, got you guys back, got custody, you know, treatment was one time for me, and I was done with drugs. I think because I hit a bottom early on.
Yeah.
You know, your dad and I still laugh about this. Like if we never had it good on that end,
yeah.
you know, which is really good because I think, you know, dealing with clients today when, you know, they think they can sell drugs or they have that criminal lifestyle, it's really difficult for them to engage in recovery
mm.
or to get clean. And so I think for your dad and I, because we could never, the criminal part just wasn't us.
Yeah.
I think we were squared drug users.
Yeah. Just like strictly, yeah. Strictly users or not.
Right. We're right. Not there was, there was none of that other stuff going on. And so, our bottom was devastating, and when we came out of that, I never had the desire to go back.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of fell into this field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sold car insurance for a little while.
Yeah.
Just kind of did some odd things, and I was at a convention, and the director from the treatment center that I had graduated from asked mm-hmm. me, did I want a job?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't have anything to give back, you know. And she was like, well, just come and see me. And I started off as an RCF, mm-hmm. a residential care facilitator.
Is that like the line staff?
Yes. That's what I started off as. And I loved it, you know. And it was like that was my purpose,
mm-hmm.
you Can know. I,
mm-hmm. For anybody here that hasn't worked residential or in like some kind of a facility, the line staff is basically your guard.
Yes.
Or your person that will provide the meals, make sure nobody's getting hurt or assaulted or anything like that. So when you say so I might use that a lot during the show, you know,
yes.
from now to the future because I worked res for quite a while. So that's what line staff means.
Yes, line staff. And so I did that for a little while, and then I became a case manager. And from there, I realized that I wanted to give back. My purpose was there was women that were losing their children.
Yeah.
And they were devastated behind that. And they would use even when they didn't want to. And they couldn't figure out why when they knew the kids needed clothes or when the bills need to be paid, why would they continue to use?
Yeah.
And so I thought it was important that they could look across the table and there would be someone there that could identify.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that knew this is... I know what you're talking about. I know this feeling, and you don't ever have to use again and you can't get your children back out of the system, and you can go on and be successful.
Yeah.
And so I was CADC1 for a little while, and then wanted to do something around management and lead clinician and, you know, kind of run a team or be second to running a team. And so then I received my CADC2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How'd that process go?
It was interesting. So with the CADC2, gives you a little bit more knowledge in regards to the rules and regulations, organ rules, and, mm-hmm. you know, you have to know about confidentiality, and it's more of the books parts of the job.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much as, I just want to be front line right there. I want to be able, you know, and I always tell people, I don't want to do management.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do face-to-face. I want to do that one-on-one type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so CADC2, but it gives me a little bit more leeway. So if I wanted to open my own business, I could.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I could run an agency and things like that.
Okay. Sounds promising.
Yeah. Yeah.
was there anything that you could think of that kind of, maybe led to your addiction? Like, was there any kind of, like, you know, because, you know, you learn things now that most drug addiction comes from, like, trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any kind of trauma that you, like, think that you can, like, pinpoint back to?
Oh, yes. I'm looking back. I know that it was just my environment and the people that we were hanging around,
yeah.
plus the unresolved mental health.
Okay.
You know, like I said early on, I was given to my mother's aunt, and there were 10 of us.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's sister, I'm sorry, who was my aunt, and there was 10 of us, and I did not know that I had siblings until I was 11.
Yeah.
And it was actually one of my older sisters that told me who I was.
Mm-hmm.
So even with that was traumatic.
Yeah.
And so when I pinpointed back, it was the things that went on in the household. You know, my needs not being met on a daily basis. You know, mm-hmm. my mom did the best she could, but she was clinically depressed.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until I got into this field that I could look back and say, oh, that's what that was.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that's what was going on, because I just thought, well, you just don't care. You're going to lay on the couch and then that's just it, you mm-hmm. know. But looking back now, I know that, you know, she was depressed. You know, my environment, my family life, all of that stuff played a major part, you know.
Yeah.
And then my biological father being around but not being present.
Yeah.
You know, so dealing with all of those feelings, drugs was the escape.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, drugs was the escape. But it is definitely connected.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who say, just stop.
Yeah.
Why don't you just stop? You
know? It's a very, like, jaded response.
Yes.
You know? Like,
yes.
It's a choice. I've seen a Facebook post when somebody was trying to, like, go on a rant, like, it's a choice, and, you know, this big, like, you know, muscle-bound dude trying to talk down about drug addiction.
Yeah.
I didn't get into a debate, but a lot of people was getting into the debate, and I was like, you know, that's good that somebody, you know,
yes.
spoke up. But, like, it's more than just a choice. You know?
Yes.
There's the things that go into, you know, addiction that keeps you going back.
That yeah,
it,
going
I mean,
back.
It was a choice the first, but, you know, something that keeps you wanting to be put, you know, like, down in those kind of conditions.
Yeah. And even the things and the situations that happen during drug use is traumatic.
Yeah.
You know, my clients, you know, they experience a lot of things even after they've started using, you know, that traumatizes them. And so that continues that cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it is. It's bigger than just, you know. My sister, your aunt, mm-hmm. she got clean. So out of 10 of us, and that's another thing. So I know that there's trauma that runs through the family behind my mother's passing, my birth mother's passing.
Yeah.
Because out of all 10 of us, everyone suffers with some type of addiction.
Uh-huh.
You know, either it's overeating or it's workaholics, you know, or anger. Or so there's your aunt. She's also in recovery now.
Mm-hmm.
But she struggled with drug addiction. And I remember her calling me and telling me, it's bigger than just us using, you
yeah.
know, and I was using. I was like, whatever, like, why are you calling me, you
yeah.
know? But then after I got clean, I looked at it and then did the work, you know, and was like, oh, my God, it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in this field you have to go back and do continue to do work.
Yeah. I heard you mention your biological father. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I had harbored ill feelings towards him. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And he had died, like, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So that's the first time I ever actually heard of him was, like, when he died.
Yeah.
I was like, what? And I was like, no, your dad ain't dead. He's right here. You know, talk about, you know, grandpa.
Yeah.
And, but I had harbored those feelings because I have cousins. I had cousins that's younger than me mm-hmm. that knew who he was.
Yes.
You know, so for a long time, I kind of was... It wasn't really healthy, like the thoughts I had. I didn't even know him, but I just felt kind of like I had like a resentment
because
I got cousins that like are 3 years younger than I am,
mm-hmm.
and they knew this guy. But I mean, I don't know what was going on between you and him.
I chose, and that was my choice.
Yeah,
you know, and that was because of the feelings I had
uh-huh.
that didn't actually come out until he was passing.
Mm-hmm.
You know. He had a massive stroke, and, you know, they called everybody. You know how our family is. Everybody go to the hospital.
Yeah.
So we all went to the hospital, and I was sitting out in the waiting area, and his sisters, my aunts, came up to me and was like, you need to go in and say goodbye to your dad. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going in there, you know. And and they sat me down, and they told me this story in regards to my dad. And I remember him when I was little, like my mom, my mom and dad, who adopted me, they would take me to my grandma's house every Saturday night.
Yeah.
Every Saturday night we'd go, and they would push me towards this man.
Mm-hmm.
And the man would be crying, and I would be holding on to daddy, and I'd be crying, and, you know, and no one ever said who he was.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that every Saturday I would go and see this man.
Yeah.
Now, he thought that everyone was keeping me from him. But mm-hmm. I didn't know who he was, you know. So he had feelings towards my mama and daddy, who are, you know, those are my parents. So I, you know, didn't want anybody to have any ill feelings towards them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had feelings towards him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on his deathbed, I was able to say, I'm sorry, like, you didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know.
Yeah.
And have some peace in that. Because, yeah, I had the resentment also. Like,
yeah.
You watched all these things going in my life, and you were right up the street, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I can, but that was my choice. Like, you had grandparents.
Yeah.
And that's who it was, you know? Yeah. And so, and that was my choice. It was like, that, you know, those are your grandparents. He's over there. We're going to leave him over there, you know? So...
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, well, thank you. I never knew that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you want to talk about like after, you know, the drug addiction and the drug rates and bottom and getting back clean. You want to talk about like life, like the first kind of steps in, like, you know, the first couple of years in recovery?
Oh, yeah. So... Well, the first couple of years of recovery, I would say like the first 5 years of recovery, mm-hmm. I was just trying to stay clean.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like a pink cloud. You know, I got the kids back, remarried your dad. You know, we went on to be in recovery and go to meetings. And I started a little program called Case Productions, which was clean and sober events.
Yeah.
So I would give like fashion shows and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then 6 years clean, and my mom, your grandma died.
Yeah.
And that was my first bout with depression. And it caused me to go on a spiral for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
I didn't use drugs, but at times I was very suicidal, made decisions that now I know that was just out of my grief and my loss and the depression.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so for the next 10 years, you know, just kind of struggling. And then with 15 years clean, going back into therapy.
Yeah.
You know, making a decision to do that.
Okay.
Because I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I was making decisions based on emotions and just, you know, I was still working in treatment. Mm-hmm. I was still doing that. And you know, I look back, it's like, oh my God, how did I do that? But
yeah.
I think that was the only thing that was keeping me going.
Was you working in treatment?
Me working in treatment, yeah. You know.
I was gonna ask you, what kept you not from relapsing?
Yeah.
Because I remember that was a hard time. You mm-hmm. know? Like, I mean, you lose a parent.
Yeah.
And you are in recovery. That has to be like a very, you gotta look at yourself like, well, this, you know, this, like, it doesn't really matter. So, right. Like, so what kept you from relapsing?
Yeah, it was you guys. Mm-hmm. And then Daddy was still alive. And I knew crack cocaine destroyed my life. And so I knew that no matter what was going on, that I was not going to pick that up again.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I never was really a drinker or any of that. But I knew that I didn't want to use,
yeah.
You know. But then the other characteristics came out, you know. Ended my marriage, went off to do some things that was not okay.
Yeah.
And continued to kind of stay in that cycle, you know, allowed other people to do things that was not okay, just kind of justified the behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know, until it was like enough was enough.
Yeah.
You know, enough was enough. But yeah, but what kept me clean was I worked in treatment.
Yeah.
You know, they could have UA'd me at any time. And on top of everything else, I just couldn't afford to lose my job, you know.
That's a good motivator, you know, not losing the job.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But then hitting the bottom, even with that, you know, and when I talk with people, I go around and I talk to people and it's like, you know, if you're not working recovery, that things come up.
Yeah.
You know, they do. Even clean and sober with multiple years clean and you find yourself against the wall.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. I remember going to those those NA meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, now you can't smoke in a building. But back then it was, you know, I was glad y'all wasn't using other stuff. But man, boy, that coffee and those cigarettes. Yeah. Just chugging coffee, smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
In a smoky basement, you know, just kind of hearing everybody's story. I really didn't realize, you know, like how you know, important I was when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but now, like, when you grow up and you realize that, like, that was just as important as breakfast.
Yes.
As eating.
Yes.
You know, because without that, it wasn't, there were, like, who knows what could have happened, you know.
Yes.
And there are some people, you know, that that can quit, you know, cold turkey and, you know, don't need recovery. But most people
need recovery.
Need something.
Yeah, need recovery.
You know.
And that did kept me a lot of days, you know, the support that I have, you know, the women, I still connect with those women.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the men, you know, just the brothers in the program, you know, me and your dad, we laugh all the time because people will look at our relationship and be like, mm-hmm. okay, but you guys are divorced and you guys both are remarried, but you guys can be in the same room together and laugh and everything is good. And we always laugh about that and say, it's only because of recovery.
Yeah.
You know, because mm-hmm. we had to do some work on ourselves,
yeah.
you know, and just to realize, you know, he's still part of my support, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm still part of his support, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Where are we going next? Oh, there we go. So did you know anything because I know like now practitioners and like school is like focused on like, you know, mental health. Like that's like the thing now.
Yes.
Was that a thing back when you first started recovery? Like, you know, was the mental health part as like heavy as it is now?
It was not. It was very separate.
Yeah.
You know, and even working years in the field, I've seen it be very separate and then come together. Mm-hmm. The early, I would say like 96, 97, all of the early 2000s, it was everybody had a mental health professional in the treatment centers.
Yeah.
You know, and then around 2005, they strayed away from that.
Yeah.
And that lasts about 3 or 4 years, and now it's coming back together again, mm-hmm. where it's not so separate. But when I was getting clean, oh, yeah, you don't tell anybody you need mental health services.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't tell anybody. It's like you got to figure that part out in uh-huh. NA.
Yeah.
You know, and what we've learned is that you don't go in. NA is not a mental health provider.
Yeah.
That's not what it is. And so a lot of people would dump their issues. There would be no resolution. And then they go and they would get loaded.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but the stigma, you know, especially for our culture, you don't tell the people your business. Yeah. You know, you just don't do it and you try to figure it out.
Yeah.
But now it's like everybody is attached,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's the trauma even before the use. And even if there's no trauma or not a lot of trauma that can be identified before the use, definitely during the use, a person will experience trauma.
Yeah.
You know, you're out on the street, you're homeless, you know, for women, they're rapes, they're, you know, yeah. even with children being removed, it's traumatizing.
Yeah.
And so that it has to be connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember Dad saying, like, hearing women's stories and it ain't mean just, like, it's a trip.
Yeah.
You know, just because, I mean, like, I can only imagine the kind of stuff that, that you have to endure
mm-hmm.
in that kind of crazy yes. lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, just, do you think, like, looking back on it, do you think that, there was, like, a disservice not incorporating mental health, like, from the beginning?
I do. Uh-huh. And I'm going to tell you why. Because there's a lot of people that have had 12, 13 attempts at recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, I know there's people that tried to get clean before I did, and yeah. now they're my clients. You know, yeah. and it's like, oh, my God, I remember you in 1991,
yeah.
you know, and their mental health is at a place where I believe if they had addressed it then,
uh-huh.
they would have been able to get some clean time, okay. you know. Like, your grandma, that was my therapist, yeah. you know. She was. I mean, she could talk me through anything, and I think that's why I went into such a depression when she passed, because I lost that link.
Yeah.
I lost that support. She never judged me. She always had words of wisdom, always, yeah. you know. And I believe early on, that's what kept me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kept me clean. Like, she was my therapist. Even though I wasn't going to therapist, I could go see grandma.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she would make it okay or give me something
mm-hmm.
to hold on to, you know.
Yeah. Do you yeah. think it's ironic that she was battling her own mental illness, but she was so helpful to you?
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then because I didn't even look at it until she was gone. And like, I went back in to get help that she was battling with mental illness,
mm-hmm.
you know, because your aunts and all those, they just said, you know, she married this alcoholic and
yeah,
she just wasn't going to do nothing. Well, she gave up,
yeah.
you know, she gave up.
And also like living in poverty
mm-hmm.
too. Like that was, you know, I mean, you look back at it now, that was... You know, that was extreme.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, like, yeah, that was a trip. And it was a trip to think about, like, you know, how the, you know, the contrast to, you know, Grandma Scott and Grandma Brown.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
You know, one grandma had like a griddle on the stove and made homemade jelly. And one grandma, I mean, she, you know, she loved us nothing, you know, like it wasn't anything less.
Yes.
But, you know, she had her own stuff going mm-hmm. on.
She had her own struggles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But always was there for somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always.
Did you see, like, if you look back now, like do you see that being a pattern? Like, even when you were a kid?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, Duke, he tells me, he said, I don't know where you get that personality from, that yeah. forgiveness, that soft-spoken, you know, personality. And mm-hmm. I know where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, she instilled that, and she instilled it into you guys, you know, that kind, giving spirit, you yeah. know, even if I'm struggling, you know, even if I'm struggling, I still have room for you at my table.
Yeah.
That's the way she was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. What kind of influences do you incorporate in your practice?
What kind of influences? I always go back to a spiritual realm, which is really kind of, I got to play around with that because, you know, you have certain ethics.
Yeah.
You know, can't bring those things into it.
Yeah.
But with the influences, you know, I talk a lot about AA or NA. I often tell clients that you have to figure out where your balance is and where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really been really important because you don't know where you're going until you know where you've been.
Yeah.
You know? And like I said, just a lot of spiritual, because there has to be a connection.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be. You mm-hmm. can't just, there has to be a power greater than you.
Yeah.
To do something.
Yeah.
You know, always. Yeah.
Mm. When I was working in the DAOs, we used to go to AA meetings a lot. And, you know, take the juveniles. And I had a coworker who was in AA. You know, and he wasn't a religious guy at all. But when it came to a higher power, you know, he was like, it's not really, you know, it's not really religion. It's just believing in something, you know, like it's believing in something that's helping you wake up, you know, and that's how he would explain it to the kids. And I mean, that was his thing. But I remember him saying that because like working with them juveniles, they were very combative, you know, like they were just against the grain. I remember like this, they had like this big thing of like, you know, Satanism was their religion, and I was like, you don't believe in that, but it was cool. It was like
right.
You know, it was just shock value, you know. So, you know, and the guy would be like, well, that's fine too, as long as he's telling you to stay clean, you know, because doing drugs is not working for you.
Right.
You know. So, because you know, when it comes to like mental health practices, I know about the ethics about religion and spirituality and all that stuff. And I think that, you know, like if somebody is for it, then you use it in your case plan.
Yes.
You know, if they're not for it, then you figure out a way.
Yes.
You know, because part of our job is to figure out a way.
Figure out a way. And that is it. How do I get you from point A to point B? You know, safely,
yeah.
You know, and yeah. And so whenever the door opens, right, I kind of wait for the client to open that door.
Yeah.
And then once they do, you know, it's different working in residential. You know, I worked in outpatient for 6 years.
Yeah.
So part of that was I worked in residential. Then it was like, well, I'm going to go out and work in outpatient. And so I did that for a little while. And then I worked as a gambling therapist. I forgot to tell you that. Yeah.
Damn,
I'm certified as a gambling therapist.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So just addictions in general. But my expertise is gambling and chemical dependency.
Yeah.
So, So just being able to wait for that door to open, you know. But with the population I work with now, they're desperate for something greater than myself.
Yeah.
You know, so when they open that door, then that can allow me to go in and give them the experience and strength that I have, you know, and some hope in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that production company you had.
Case Productions.
Because I remember those fashion shows.
Yeah.
Actually, me and my partner, you know, the Hamptons was talking about those fashion shows, one of our other ventures we got going on.
Yeah.
and just how those used to go. But like, what got you into doing that?
So your dad and I, we started with a Ken's Cards and Gifts.
I do remember. Okay, I remember that.
And we did balloons, and we did greeting cards, and we made coffees, mm-hmm. right? This was before the mocha machines and all of that, and we made fruit drinks. And so, you know, there's... We had a lot of ideas, and then we just didn't have the support, like, from the fam. Like, there was just no family support. And so when it came down to, we got to pay bills, or can we just step out on faith and try these things, we decided not to do that and just pay bills.
Yeah.
But then we looked up, and, like, people had balloon shops. And, and it was like they took our idea, you know. But I wanted to be able... What I noticed is when people got clean, their self-esteem was damaged, you know, from using drugs and, you know, and being called all types of names and just being at a low. And so I wanted to boost people's self-esteem.
Yeah.
And that's where I got into Case Productions. Your dad actually named it, right? Because I was like, well, it's Cheryl Annette Scott Entertainment.
Yeah.
Right? Because it was Cheryl C. Annette A. Scott S. and Entertainment E, right? He was like, well, no, we'll do Case Clean and Sober events. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Okay. So then we did that. And that ran for 7 years.
Yeah.
7 years. And I see kids now that are grown that will say, I was in your fashion show and Youth on a Positive Mission. And it's like, oh my God, you know? But just wanted to be of service. My goal was to have a nightclub that was clean and sober, you know, because I was 29 when I got clean and your dad was 31. And when people say you can't ever drink or use again, I'm like, well, dang, I'm 29 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I got to figure something out. And your dad has always been a hustler. Mm-hmm. You know, he still hustles selling cars, but he's always been a hustler. So it was real easy for us to just do that. And we would go into the clubs and do fashion shows, and then, you know, because we had kids, it was like, well, let's do something for the youth.
Yeah.
It was real easy to get, you know, we wanted to incorporate you guys in part of our recovery process. So that was real easy. We just didn't realize it was going to take off like it did.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Youth on a Positive Mission is still patented. No one can use that but your dad and I.
Okay.
Which is good.
Why don't you bring it back?
Yeah, we should. We probably should, you know. But yeah, it was a good thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember the last one you did, I was like 16. And I remember you, I felt like there was like my rite to passage. Because you was like, do you want to be in it? And I was like, no, I think I'm good. Mm-hmm. And you was like, all right. I was like, cool.
Yeah. Because before that, I was dragging you guys I had to do it.
I had to sing them songs. It was... There's a picture. I took a picture on my phone, and you know how we had the you know, you come out, everybody come out together, and you go and get dressed, and you have like if you was a little kid, I'm just gonna run it down. I remember this. If you were like a little kid, you would like do like this to basically like streetwear shirt and jeans or whatever, and then you might get a chance to like sing together. But if you was like a teenager, you got like the, you know, you got like the prom scene, you got like the pajama scene,
yes.
You know,
the formal wear, the nightwear, the evening wear,
Oh man, I was that. Those good times.
Yeah. I still have all of the portfolios. Mm-hmm. And I go through them every once in a while, and I say, you know, I need to find these people. Yeah. You know, and some of the people, it's sad because they passed on, and, you know, Hilton and all those people, they're no longer here, but they were in those shows.
Yeah.
And then I have, like, my youth shows. People are grown and adults and, you know, in their 30s, and it's like, I have pictures of you when you were 10. Yeah. So, you know, every once in a while I'll go through it and say, I need to really find these people and let them know I have their pictures.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember seeing a few people like just being through SEI or like, you know, like them marrying somebody I know. I was like, oh man, you was in my mom's fashion show.
Yeah.
Back in the day. Well, I mean, you're right. That did run for, that was a big thing, you know, but, you know, before the, you know, neighborhood, I got broken up. You know,
yes.
that was a big. I mean, I think Portland. I think all the everybody. I feel like everybody in the black community was going through the same thing. Our family was going through.
Yes.
You know, like drug addiction and just trying to be clean and just trying to survive.
Yes.
You know? And you only had like three choices of schools you went to. You mm-hmm. like it was like Humboldt, Tubman, Jeff, or Grant, or something like
yep,
that. You know,
that was it.
So I feel like everybody, you know, kind of knew each other. So how do you gauge success in your practice?
Well, you know, a lot of therapists will say, if we can just do harm reduction,
mm-hmm.
you know, I try to get my clients to a place where they are successfully parenting their children.
Yeah.
Even after treatment.
Okay.
Like to give them some skills so that they can go on to be a better parent,
mm-hmm.
you know, a better member of society. The difficult thing is like insurance has stepped in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm saying, well, they need like 9 months. You know, for me, I needed a year.
Yeah.
Of, you know, I went into treatment. I was in treatment for 7 months. And then after that, I went into 3 months transitional housing because you guys were placed with me.
Yeah.
And so we stayed for another 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed that, you know, and for yeah. a lot of our clients today, I think they need that.
Uh-huh.
But insurance says, well, they get 90 days, you know, yeah. and you need to authorize every 30 days. Mm-hmm. And then we decide, you know, so it makes it real difficult. So the clients that I deal with now, how I measure their success is, do they have a home group? Are they engaged in some type of self-help? So yeah. I don't just say NA or AA.
Uh-huh.
I used to just say, you got to do NA or AA.
Yeah.
But there's many roads to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing actively in your church? I have one client, she does a crochet group. I taught them how to crochet. They crochet every week.
Yeah.
And people are staying clean, you yeah. know? So whatever the self-help group, as long as there's a group of people that are getting together for the betterment of themselves
mm-hmm.
and their families. And then are they employable? Do they have a job?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my clients, because my expertise is criminality or mm-hmm. criminal justice also, and with addiction. And so have they committed any crimes?
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and, you know, for a lot of them, it's like, well, I haven't stole anything from the store, but I sold my food stamps. Oh, that's still a crime.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So really working with them. I really worked a lot in my agency to create a criminality process group.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be a forum for people to go and talk about their behaviors in a safe place.
Yeah.
So that's how we would gauge the, you know, the success.
Yeah.
You know, you commit any crimes, you're parenting, you're getting up and you're taking a bath every day. You know what I mean? Mm. Like little stuff, because the addiction robs them of so much, you know?
Yeah.
I still get out the bed and make my bed 26 mm. years later.
Yeah.
Because I had to learn how to do that again, because when I got clean, there was no bed. There yeah. was no sheets. There was none of that.
Yeah.
So when I went to treatment, that was like one of the first skills that I learned. And I still do that,
mm-hmm.
you know? I still do that. My husband will say, I better hurry up and, or he'll tell me, okay, I'm not, like if you go to the bathroom, he'll say, yeah. okay, I'm going back to bed. Cause he know I'll make the bed and it'll be made up when you get back. But
yeah.
those are some of the skills, you know, and people might say, well, what do you mean? That's basic. But if you're dealing with some stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's the hardest thing to do
yeah.
is to make my bed.
It's like the basics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. How do you know when it's time to disengage from a caseload or a client?
Well,
you know, we got those boundaries where it's like, me and our relationship right now isn't the healthiest, and we're not going to get any progress, so I think I need to step back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, usually they'll be the one to say that. No. So when it gets to a place where I'm not therapeutically able to reach them anymore.
Yeah.
You know, when they become very, they can be argumentative, because I give them a safe place to, if you disagree with what I'm saying, then we could talk about that.
Yeah.
If there's no progress moving forward, you know, like I work in residential. So if they are not coming into their sessions, they're not coming into groups, then we will sit down and have a discussion about that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need something else? Because it's such a small community where I work, I went back into the inner city to work in treatment. And I made that decision after working in another treatment center. And I looked around and I was the only African-American therapist. And there was like 3 African-American clients. They housed like 20 clients.
Yeah.
They had 3. And each one of these 3 was always being staffed about their anger.
Yeah.
Right? I wasn't a counselor at that time, but I was counseling these women.
Yeah.
Like they were like, well, we're just going to put them with you, Cheryl. And I was like, but I'm not even certified.
Yeah.
Well, you can work with them and somebody will sign off on your stuff. And it was like, okay, but you're going to sign off on my paperwork. I'm not licensed. And so I was in a meeting out at JDH and this African-American lady, she says, well, why don't you try coming to work for us? And ooh. I did. And I love it. And, where I work at now, our population is African-American.
Yeah.
Our target is African-American women that are opiate addictions and pregnant.
Oh.
That's our target. Okay. And so just because I needed to do some work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and the women needed to know they had a safe place.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, as African-Americans, I can be boisterous and I raise my hands when I'm talking and speaking, you know.
Yeah.
And so to some people that could be really, you know, oh, she's angry.
Yeah.
Well, my kids are gone. I'm hungry and I'm homeless and I'm coming out of a DV relationship and yeah. I'm on probation. So, yeah, I'm a little angry, you know.
Right, I'm angry. Yeah.
So just to have a forum like that. So,
I speak with my hands, too, when I speak in front of people.
But
I think that just because in my mind it helps me with, like, my stutter.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when I talk with my hands, it's not like I have to. It's just, like, I feel like, you know, it's like a, I don't want to say coping mechanism, but it's just like a mental thing.
Yeah.
You know, it probably doesn't do anything for me, but it feels like it does.
And so then it does.
Okay, I guess it does.
Yeah, if it feels like it, that makes you comfortable, then it does. Yeah. Your auntie Barbara Jean, she speaks with her hands too, and she's a stutter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your grandma Addie was a stutter, and I probably didn't know that, but I'm going to tell you now. Yeah, so you got it honest.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, yeah, but you know, so you look at me, I'm 6'1", mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to say my weight, but... And when I speak with my hands. And a lot of times it's being misread, like, okay, so are you upset about something? It's like, no, I'm not upset. You know, but the clients, they needed to have a place where they weren't judged or, you know, that they could feel free to do that. So I offer the forum. I try to offer a forum for them to be able to do that, mm-hmm. a place for them to be able to do that. So I haven't really had any clients, well, I'm going to go back to your question about has it been to someone that I haven't been able to work with? The community is really small because of where I work.
Yeah.
So I'm now treating third generations.
Okay.
Okay. I've known their grandma.
Yeah.
I've known their mama, and now here they come.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of clients that I have to back out of because I know them.
Yeah.
You know, or to them, I'm Auntie Cheryl.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't treat you if,
yeah,
you know,
that's probably not a good idea.
Yeah. So that would be the only flaw that happens. And other than that, I mean, my clients go on and I always tell them it's not me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just laying the groundwork. Like they're doing the work. You know, I think that is really important to empower women and men, you know, because even when I worked in outpatient with men, it's really empowered because they've been beat down for so long.
Yeah.
It's like, if my shoes matched, tell me I did a good job.
Yeah.
You know, if my hair is clean today, then tell me that I look nice, you know.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you do like a lot of cultural competent treatment.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Like you incorporate race into the, like, you know, into their treatment.
Yes.
That's good. Do you, what do you think, or why do you think there was like a disconnect with like mental health and communities of color?
I think it's the stigma. And then also the lack of funding.
Okay.
We run into that a lot. Like where I work. So we can get the meds, but there's no prescriber.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or the prescriber is in Beaverton, you know?
Yeah.
And then my client goes out there and yeah, she's under distress. And so now you want to say, oh, she needs to, you know, she needs some other type of help, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's just with that, it's just the lack of funding in the community. And then on top of that, there's just not enough awareness about mental health.
Yeah.
You know, our clients, we really, because we're a dual diagnosis program, you know, we try to wait until they kind of clean up a little bit, but we encourage them, you know, to at least have an evaluation.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a bad thing, you know, with that. And then even, you know, sometimes I'll tell them my story. Like, you know, I've struggled with that also.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't mean you're going to always need the medication, but right now you might need the medication. So let's try it and see.
Yeah.
And, you know, that works a lot too.
Yeah. Funding is a whole other topic that I'm going to dive into one of these later episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, because I remember talking to Dad, and he was, you know, when I asked him what he thought mental health was, and he only had like he had like, you know, the more severe.
Oh, yes.
You know, so I feel like that could be like a, you know, like just you think like you got mental health issues. There's no like, you know, there's no gauge. There's no mild, low, or severe. Mm-hmm. It's all, are you mental? Then you crazy.
Right.
You know, so like nobody wants to be crazy. Nobody wants to be labeled that. And I also feel like, you know, because it's just as a people, we've been beat down for so long.
Right.
That it's like, you know, you just learn to kind of move on with it.
Yeah, you persevere.
Yeah,
you know, right. You see Uncle Jojo, and Uncle Jojo, you know, he'd been a little crazy for a while, and everybody just take care of Uncle Jojo.
Uh huh.
But you don't tell anybody about Uncle Jojo.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of that has happened, and so generations of that. You know, there's always someone that is struggling. You know, but then you have like grandma that's just on like just clinically depressed. That medication probably would have helped, right? But it wasn't severe enough. And so when you look at the gauge, like, okay, so you got to really be really crazy.
Yeah.
Or you just lazy and you just need to get up.
Yeah.
And push through it.
Yeah. Get over it.
Right.
You know.
And so that's where I think the barrier is. You know, that people need to know that, you know, I might not need Zoloft or some other medication for a long period of time, but I need it right now. And it's okay that I take it right now.
I think that too, because like I know, you know, this guy working in residential, we have people doing what we used to have people when I used to work, they were taking these meds. And I think like, you know, like the nurse or the doctor they wouldn't need to use it no more because it's like they obviously don't work. So let's get you off of these meds, you know, let's get you off the routine of, you know, coming to the window and, you know, because, you know, it probably worked when you first got here and now you stabilized. Now you kind of causing trouble on the unit. So maybe let's back up off the meds right now. Let's try to use some natural things, you know, like some talk therapy.
Mm-hmm, some natural coping skills,
talking to your problems, you know.
Yeah.
So you being a practitioner, but also being a person in recovery, have you ever, like, been in a meeting and, like, your, like, behaviors of your coworkers, like, triggered you? So, like, I have an example.
Okay.
I was working at a few jobs back, and I was working with these, you know, these white women who were case managers.
I remember that.
And I remember we had a client, a little client, and they were talking about the client's mom. And they were just saying, like, you know, you know, she's crazy. Have you read the email that she wrote? And just kind of just going back and forth about her, just kind of really not giving her a chance, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just, I've never been, like, triggered in this work, you know, just ever. That was one of the only times. And I remember just thinking, like, you know, like, when my mom was trying to get clean.
Yes.
I wonder, was there, like, some women saying that about her? Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember, like, just, I had to, like, walk outside. Just, like, I was so pissed. Yeah. You know, I probably would have got fired if I stayed in that office.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like living in that life, being in that lifestyle and coming to this work, that's probably going to happen more often than not. So has that ever happened to you?
Oh, yes. Quite a few times, mm-hmm. you know. And then I even go back to my own story, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, so she's doing the best that she can mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah.
You know. What I really appreciate about where I work at now, like it took me a while to get to the place that I'm at now. With a clinical director that I work under, is very trauma informed, and you know, and even the staff.
Yeah.
You know, like she makes sure that we have the trainings that we need. You know, I mean, we're back in the clinical room, and every once in a while, somebody will say something off the wall, and you just have to correct them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, so she's doing the best that she can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the skills that she has right now.
Yeah.
You know, there's only a couple of us that are in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But the other clinicians and the other dual, because there's 2 mental health therapists and there's 3 addictions counselors. And then there's the clinical director who is a licensed mental health therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so every once in a while, you know, we have other staff back there, case managers and things like that. And, you know, they'll say something that's out there.
Yeah.
You know? And then we just have to remind them, you know, that she's doing the best that she can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with our frontline staff, like you were talking about earlier, we get a lot of that where, oh, my gosh, he's out here flipping out in the milieu. And, well, they just canceled our child visit.
Yeah.
You know, and so that would cause that reaction, you know. So I think it's a lot about just informing everyone, which our team is really, I mean, I'm real thankful for our team right now because we have that. But I've been at other places and it's like, okay, so like I said, that other program that I worked at before I went to this program, it was, it was like, she's out here screaming and yelling and, you know, and did you see what she said or what she's wearing and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So instead of being part of the solution, they want to be part of the problem. And so I'm real fortunate about working with people that are part of the solution.
That's
took
good.
Us a while to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, working, just like, why do you work in this field? I remember, you know, so from that job, a few jobs from that job, mm-hmm. you know, working with juveniles and they, you know, they, an outpatient.
Yeah.
And, we had one, staff that was like, did we give these kids too many options, you know, like, you know, we give them so much, you know, like leeway to do their homework. You know, I was a kid, I had to do my homework mm-hmm. that night. And I was like, well, you also had horses too.
Yeah. You know,
so, so, I mean, you know, there is that. You know?
And everybody's background is different,
right? You know,
so. And everybody's, you know, everybody's story is different. You know, that's one thing that I often tell people, like, everybody's story and everybody's journey is different. And it doesn't have to be the same way.
Yeah.
You know, client A's journey does not have to be like client B's journey. Mm-hmm. And when we get into that place where everybody's journey for them to get from point A to point B has to be the same road, that's where we're going to run into problems.
Yeah.
And so it took me a while to get that part of it, you know, mm-hmm. to get that piece of it. But it's like they need to do this and they need to do that. I think that everybody that's working in this field should work in residential at one time or
yes,
another.
Yes, I definitely
think that should be
that.
Part of the licensing. Like
that should
you need
be
to
your
work.
First job
yes.
is residential
yes.
treatment. Any
yes.
kind, whether it's a jail or it's a treatment.
Yes.
Wherever the doors lock behind you.
Yes.
You need one of those jobs if you're going to be a social worker.
Yes.
I think, you know.
Yes.
Because, you think too. Because, you know, it's hard work.
It is.
You know, it's hard work. You see people, like, you know, at you can see them at their best, definitely. You do see them at their best, yes. You know, at the, you know, in their journey. But it's just, you learn so much because there you have clients that, are, that, you know, that'll be no problem.
Yeah.
From day one.
They've learned how to work the system.
You
know, yeah. Yes.
you have clients that be up and down.
Yes.
You have clients that'll be kind of, you know, mild. And then you have some that, you know, will just be a problem the whole time. But then when they get out, they don't ever come back.
That's right.
So it's like it just makes you versatile.
Yeah.
In how you provide services.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So yeah, you definitely have to work residential if you're going to do
it. I just really think, you know, I know now that we have DHS workers and it's like they need to just work in residential.
Yeah.
You know, because I believe that would take away some of that judgment. You know, like they just don't want to do better. Well, they can't.
Yeah.
And if they could, they would.
Yeah.
You know, they really would. Do you think they want to stay in this misery? I don't think so.
Yeah. That's true. Nobody wants to be miserable.
And so it's not their choice just to make your life miserable about doing child visits and these things and all these other things. It's like, if they could do better, they would.
Yeah. That's
true. You know, but yeah. Yeah. I often say, you know, when... Because somehow it's me and another clinician. We always end up with the rowdy clients, you know. And the way they do it, the way we used to. Now I'm the clinical director. She assigns clients. But the way they used to do it was we'd pull them all out on the table and they'd look at their chart. And then that's how we would assign them.
Yeah.
So they'd be like, oh, yeah. We call each other Miss at our job as part of our culture, our cultural piece of our job. So they, Miss Cheryl, you need this one. She needs you, you know. And it's like, you know what? She'll keep putting her stuff out there, but it gives her an opportunity to work on her issues.
Yeah.
It's better than the one that's quiet over in the corner that has it all together. She's not going to work on anything.
Yeah.
So I want them to be loud and boisterous and angry. And that's the real person. I could work with that all day.
Yeah. I used to say that too. Like the person that's, you know, that's emotional.
Yes.
Like that's the one I prefer to work with.
Yes.
You know,
because it's out in the open.
Yeah.
And they're going to get some skills because each time they engage in that behavior, we're going to work on a new skill, right?
Yeah.
And so by the end of it, they've engaged in that behavior 50 or 60 times. How many times do they have to use that skill?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Okay. How do you cope with stress nowadays?
Nowadays, I crochet. Yes. I have not smoked a cigarette in 10 months. Yay. Okay, so yes. I'm really happy about that. And I use that as my recovery also, because I say, now if I smoke a cigarette, I'm relapsing. So yeah. I just won't smoke.
Damn.
Yeah. So, I talk to people, I talk to my support, I go to church. So I've just started that back up and so I'm loving it.
Yeah,
because I had to separate religion from my spiritual base.
Yeah.
You know, I had to do that because it was like I didn't want to be a part of the religion piece of it. I just need to go and praise God. So,
yeah.
Went back to church and I'm loving it. And, you know, I connect with people that are clean and sober.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
if it's just me and my buddy, we go shopping, you know, we'll go out to eat or.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
nice.
Yeah. Play with my grandbabies. That's another. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. They appreciate you.
Yeah. Every once in a while, I'll connect back with my therapist.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm really, really going through some stuff. But I haven't had to do that in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. That is pretty good.
Yeah.
So is there anything you would tell your younger self?
To take it easy. I would tell my younger self to be kind to myself, to not judge myself so hard. Just to take it easy. Because I believe that all the expectations that I had or that my family had on me and your dad, it was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, ask for help. I would definitely put it out there and not try to figure out stuff my own self.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Is there anything else that you want to, anything you got going on, anything you want to plug while we're here?
Well, no, I'm good. I'm loving this. I could do this every week. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I just, you know, I believe that my higher power, like I had to go through addiction to be pulled out of that to be able to reach back and help somebody else.
Yeah.
So with my clients, you know, most people burn out at 5-6 years doing the type of work that I do. But it's my passion. I love my job. I love what I do. I love the women, mm-hmm. you know, and I have to keep taking care of myself in order to do that.
Okay.
So that's where I'm at with it.
Nice. All right.
Yeah.
Before we go, I remember, you know, there was like a time where, because I didn't know Dad's dad. Mm-hmm. He died before I died. I remember there was time. I can't really talk to him about it. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, he doesn't want, I mean, he does, but I give him a space around that issue.
Yeah.
I remember you told me a story about how his presence, and I remember you told me that story, and I was like, ooh, I like that. You know, mm-hmm. like how he said, like how he, when he walked in a room, everybody would get quiet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he'd be, you know, because, you know, he used to, you know, help run the business, family business.
Yes.
He said when he walked in that boardroom, it was just like,
yeah.
I was like, ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
I need to be that.
Your grandpa Albert was a classy man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a classy man, and he wouldn't say much. But yeah. what he said was deep,
yeah.
right? And he would just sit back and let people talk, and then he'd say it. He'd just put it out there, and then he'd be quiet. But, yeah, he was. That. Yeah, and I can see why your dad is just like, because your dad, that hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when our addiction really took mm-hmm. off. I remember the exact day we had just buried him.
Mm-hmm.
We were at my sister, at your auntie's house,
mm-hmm.
and Sharon was there and Carol was there and they're gone on
mm-hmm.
and Robert was there and Barbara Jean and John was just my sister and my brother-in-law and he was selling drugs
mm-hmm.
and Irma Jean was selling drugs and they gave us drugs
mm-hmm.
and we used and from that point forward and I wasn't pregnant with you yet
yeah
and from that point forward it was crazy
yeah
but it was that day. It was that day, yeah.
Man, well, I've been talking for a while, and I'll let you go home to your husband. He's probably like, where the hell is all? Sorry, Duke. Every episode, Gmail is hiphopsocialworker@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, HHSocialWork. You can even follow me on Instagram now, at hiphopsocialworkerpod. And also, like I said, I'm saying every week, I'm not too proud to ask for donations to make this thing grow. I'm on Cash App, $CScott85. Anything else you want to say, Mom?
Oh, no. I love you. I'm proud of you. Keep it up.
Thank you. I'm proud of you, too.
Oh, thank you.
All right. And we are done.